So the meeting is being recorded. I have two announcements to make. One is the fact that we are operating under the Hyperledger antitrust policy. Well, actually, it is a Linux Foundation antitrust policy. If you do not wish to participate and not agree with this antitrust policy, then please get off the call, because that's the only requirement. The other requirement is our code of conduct, which implies that, or which requires that we treat each other with respect, even when we are disagreeing with them, with each other, I mean. So that's about it. And from now, we are gonna have Christoph and Carla present on the important chain of trust that exists between organizations and roles, and how that can strengthen the participation in DLT networks of individuals in corporations. You can start your presentation anytime you choose to.
All right. Thanks so much. I think Carla will start, and I will try to share my slides while I'm doing that. Hi, Daniel. Good to see you again. I think we met at the end of last year in Malaga, in Spain, actually, right?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Good to see you again.
Yes, you too.
So, Christoph, do you also want to introduce yourself and our roles before we kick off the presentation?
Certainly. So, just looking if I can share the PowerPoint, the title page. Do you see a white slide, full
yes,
size?
Yes, we do.
Saying accelerating digital identity with the LAI? Okay, great. Okay, thank you again very much for the invitation. Carla and I are from the Global LAI Foundation. I will just briefly introduce myself, and then Carla will kick it off. So I am working with GLIVE since 2015, from the beginning, when the foundation actually started its operation. I am since then responsible for IT development and operations, so everything technical within GLIVE. And my team is responsible for all GLIVE services from a technical perspective, creating them and running them. And I'm collaborating with Carla in these projects here, where we're looking into the future of digital identity with the LAI. And with this, I hand it over to Carla.
Hey, thank you, Christoph. So Carla McKenna, the head of standards for the Global LAI Foundation. I had association with the LAI right from the beginning, from when the legal entity identifier itself was a concept. And my association came because of my standards background. At that time, I chaired the ISO Technical Committee for Financial Services, TC68. Which actually developed the LAI standard itself as an ISO standard, and then was invited later on to become part of the GLIVE management team as the head of standards. So we're going to give you, go into the next slide, a brief overview of what an LAI is, how the LAI could help in the digital world with digital economy, how does the proposal practically work, and then to bring you through some use cases where we see some applicability, some of which we've already tested in the form of proofs of concept. So we start briefly with what is an LAI. So the LAI, if we go to the next one, the initiative itself came out of the 2008 financial crisis in response by the regulators. The regulators found that in order to be able to unravel and understand what happened to the world financial markets and their players at the time of the financial crisis, that they had an awfully hard time on being able to identify counterparties and those responsible for the transactions that they were looking at, not only from an operating perspective, but from a financial legal perspective of who was really responsible for that kind of activity, and and who would be legally at risk for that kind of activity. And this was because that even though committees like my own in ISO catered to standards from an operating or an intermediary perspective in order for transaction-based services for those players in order to be able to talk to each other, there really wasn't an international standard that allowed for the legal entities responsible for those transactions to be identified. And so therefore, there was an issue with not only data collection, but data aggregation and data analysis at that particular point in time. Think of the major world banks all identifying Lehman and Lehman entities, for example, all in a different way, mostly in a proprietary way. And also none of this tie to the legalities of what Lehman entity, for example, would be exposed because that particular transaction went wrong, only who was operationally responsible for executing it. So this went all the way up to the global level with the Financial Stability Board. And at that particular point in time, it was decided that by the group of 20, that not only a standard would be put in place, but an operation or an infrastructure in order to be able to implement it. And that's where the Global LEI Foundation was born. So the foundation is a Swiss nonprofit foundation. It's our main entity. Actually, we've also just opened a related entity in the U.S. called Glyph Americas to carry out some strategies here in the U.S. The standard itself, the LEI, is a 20-digit alphanumeric code, and here's the ISO standard number. The code connects to a set of reference data, two types, one on the entity side of things, so name, transliteration name, address, headquarters, legal form, those kinds of things about the organization, and then also certain relationships, parent, ultimate and direct parent accounting consolidation relationships, relationships of certain entities to funds, international branches, etc. So we've also over time introduced some relationships. All of our development is tied to what we call policies by the regulators who oversee the global LEI system that grew out of the initiative from the Financial Stability Board. So we do have a set of layers where we have regulatory oversight. The GLYPH is kind of the central operating unit. And then we actually deliver LEIs with partners, a network around the world of 36 partners that we have that actually issue LEIs and collect this reference data that we've just talked about. The system was set up so that the data is freely accessible and publishable from a repository, a central one, that GLYPH and definitely Christoph's team has a hand in being able to keep up and running, where we collect data at least on a daily basis from these 36 partners for any changes to the existing records and also to record any LEIs and their records that have either been retired or created since the last time. So if we go to the next slide. So what does this mean for LEI in the digital world? So one of the features of the legal entity identifier, some of the features of the legal entity identifier itself, one, it was supposed to be a global standard, available and being able to be assigned on an international basis. Also unique. Not to reuse or duplicate codes. Any entity is only allowed one LEI in order to be able to do that. And we check for duplicates to make sure that an LEI hasn't already been issued for an entity. And the identification is permanent. So it's persistent. Even if an entity does retire, we still keep the historical of records of what that LEI record looked like at the time that they did retire and historical records behind there. And we don't then reuse any of the codes as well. And so because of this, we see these particular strengths as matching up very, very nicely with some of the needs from the digital world, unique, permanent, international, et cetera. So we've done two things in this area. One effort is to combine the strengths of the LEI in what we see for organizational identity in digital certificates. And I'm going to go through the premises that we use for that. We've actually issued our LIFE annual report for 2 years in a row now, actually signing them with digital certificates of our CEO and of our board chair using these LEI embedded digital certificates. The second is the one that we're going to spend most time on today and go into a lot of detail, and that's the use of the LEI and verifiable credentials. And of course, I don't need to tell you where verifiable credentials came from, so we can put the next slide on. So I mentioned we did some proofs of concept with this. Even though we would like to be able to enhance the use and value of the LEI in the private sector as well, the Global LEI Foundation and system was developed as we alluded to before as a public-private partnership. And for the first years of the LEI system, the focus has clearly been on capital markets, regulatory frameworks, and use of identifying in regulatory frameworks that came out of the financial crisis. But this is one of the ways that we can combine the LEI with the strength of verifiable credentials in order to be able to apply to more business-related use cases. So we've done proofs of concept. We'll go over them at the end. We tested the technique for automated issuance and verification, organizations having and using LEIs. We also connected these as the background material that Vipin has given you to not only organizations, but recognizing that people act on behalf of organizations and to relate them back through the LEI and their role within that organization for what they're allowed and legally able to do. And we're blockchain agnostic on this. We actually, the first two POCs we did was for the exact same use case, one on Hyperledger Indy and the other one on Ethereum. So if we can go on to the next slide. So this is the concept that we put together in order to be able to form the basis for both the LEI appearing in digital certificates and the LEI appearing in verifiable credentials. We start with the organization or the legal entity. There are people working for it, employees and official representative that have certain rights in order to be able to do things. In acting on behalf of that organization, we have this triple concept of taking the organization, the person who's able to act on behalf, and in what capacity or organization role. If we go on to the next slide, we now relate this back to where we are from an information and a standard perspective. So if we take the first pillar of the triple concept, we have a standard for that. That would be the ISO 17442 LEI standard, all of those contained in the global LEI system. The person has a legal name for which they can actually prove. So we use that as the standard for identifying the person. And the organization role at this particular point in time, anything that we've done so far on this, has been using just an official string, CEO, board chair, et cetera, on here. But we actually just this morning had a kickoff meeting in ISO TC68, one of the subcommittees that is actually looking into developing an ISO standard that would also produce lists of official roles that could go into these credentials. The next slide. So based on this triple concept, in the case of the verifiable credentials, we would expect that legal entities would create verifiable credentials and put them into the equivalent of an organization wallet for these credentials, not only representing official roles, but you know, also for maybe business transactions and even certification and processes that need to be executed within the legal entity itself. But for the purpose of our POCs and for the purpose of the discussion that we're going to present today, we really focused in on those official roles that could be proven in the public domain. And this would be a rendering of what this would look like to us with the Hyperledger Indy example that we did with the Sovereign Network. So next. And so these are the players that I'm going to introduce, and then I'm going to turn it over to Christoph in order to be able to give you detail on how they interact and how this all fits together. But our concept is based on a chain of trust. So Glyph is the source of truth for the LAIs that have been attested to and validated for inclusion in the global LAI system. We rely on our LAI issuers to supply us with this data and to update it on a regular basis. And then legal entities have relationships with LAI issuers and not directly with Glyph. And of course, legal entities have relationships according to official roles and responsibilities with the people who work for them and act on their behalf. So we've created a scenario in which Glyph would issue a verifiable credential to one or more LAI issuers who want to offer this service in addition to what they do in regular collection of LAI data and assignment of the LAI codes. Legal entities could request from the LAI issuer to have a digital version of their LAI issued in the form of a digital credential in a verifiable credential according to the standard. And then the legal entity could start to kick off and the process in order to be able to issue and populate their organization wallet with the VCs that they issue to people who act on their behalf. And of course, this also puts us in a position to have the chain of verification go all the way back from the person to the legal entity to the LAI issuer, that they still are operating for the global LAI system, and that the original credential came from the source of truth, which was Glyph. Also, any LAI data user we're proposing would be able to do that and could verify what credentials are actually out there and discoverable if presented by the legal entity. So I'm going to turn it over to Christoph now with that background, and he's going to take you through step by step.
Thank you, Carla. So let us see how practically verifiable credentials can be issued to persons acting in roles for organizations and how this chain of trust is actually established. So we have a model with four actors actually in place. At the top, the Global LAI Foundation, that is us, who is sort of the governing organization in the whole thing and the root of trust for for the chain of trust. Together, also part of the global LAI system, are the LAI issuers here on the right-hand side. Carla mentioned it in the beginning. We have currently 36 of these organizations with a worldwide coverage. And as to date, they have issued some 1.7 million LAIs to legal entities. We have the legal entities, obviously, on the left-hand side, which are the companies who have or have not yet an LAI, and either together with the process of receiving an LAI or after that want to receive verifiable credentials. And at the bottom, we have the LAI data user who consumes the data, and we'll see how they work together. So in a first step, Glyph would receive a verifiable credential, which says nothing else than Glyph is Glyph and is authorized to provide verifiable credentials to LAI issuers. And this is the next step. In addition to what happens in the analog world, the accreditation process that is in place today to basically certify LAI issuers that they have all the capabilities from a legal, technical, financial, and all the other perspectives that we check before somebody can become an LAI issuer. Glyph would provide a verifiable credential to them, a so-called digital accreditation, which allows LAI issuers to prove that they are digitally accredited and are able to issue verifiable credentials to their clients, the legal entities. So this is the step that is not new. That is the issuance of LAIs. I have quickly talked about it. LAI issuers are the ones who actually issue and maintain LAIs for legal entities. And once such an LAI has been received by a legal entity, they can now in this new world request to receive also a digital LEI or verifiable LEI, a verifiable credential containing their legal entity identifier, which allows them to prove that they are representing this legal entity identifier, and more. So once the LEI issuer has provided the legal entity with such a verifiable credential, the legal entity in the next step can issue verifiable credentials to their staff, either in official roles, which might be publicly discoverable, and we will come to that in a later step, or also to for just very practical purposes of identification or authentication within the organization. For example, verifiable credentials could be used to authorize for access to certain facilities of an organization or to allow access to certain IT systems and all the use cases that you can imagine, and more. If you just think a representative of a legal entity having a verifiable credential can use this to sign every single business transaction in the digital world in a very efficient way, and that makes like business communication so powerful in comparison to today's world, I think the possibilities are really limitless what can be achieved with that. Now that the employees have the verifiable credentials and are happily working with them, we said for some specific roles it would be relevant that they are discoverable. So when a legal entity decides for specific roles, that should be the case. The idea is that they report that back via our federated systems, and based on existing file transmission processes, they could report their discoverable information back to their LEI issuer. And the LEI issuer, they are like aggregators, and would report this in turn back to the Global LEI Foundation, who could consolidate this information and make it available in a central way, so that the LEI data user could not only verify the correctness and the validity of verifiable credentials directly with the legal entity, but could also discover the existence of such role credentials directly at the website of the Global LEI system, where a global register of entities having LEIs is already existing today. So there would be this central yellow pages for businesses, which could be leveraged for that. And we will show in one or two slides or so how this could look. And this all leads for verifiable credentials to be used in this variety of digital economy use cases, and some of them will be explained by Carla when I have finished, and that's like the basis for all of this. And based on the fact that the existence of verifiable credentials have been reported by legal entities back to the LEI issuer and then up to the GLIF, so on the left hand side you just see the GLIF website as it looks today. And the idea is that there could be an additional section just displaying roles, specifically not displaying names. So all data that is published by the Global LEI Foundation is completely accessible and open to anybody. So it would not contain any personally identifiable information, but it would just be a hook so that data users could make a request for verification, and then the owner, the holder of the certificates or their organizations, that's where the organizational wallet comes into play, is able to reveal the information and to verify not only that the credential itself is correct and valid. So in our example here, there's a CEO called Sandra Seiner with her role as Carla has described earlier, and because the LEI is also embedded in this credential, there's a strong link to the organization. But they could on top also verify that the legal entity is a valid one, going up that chain of trust, and even that the LEI issuer is one that has been accredited by GLIF. So this whole chain of trust can be gone up, and you can be sure that the whole chain is intact. by this process. And just quickly on the technical architecture, and I'm not going into too much detail here, but one message I want to convey is it wasn't very hard to achieve that. So it's not a production system that we have created. It was a POC, but we have created it with some partners with full functionality. So everything I just described on these slides have been created as systems, and we have done that with real organizations and with real technology. And all we had to do for that was basically leveraging the sovereign network with Hyperledger Indy, obviously, and added some management functionality like creation and revocation of certificates, and to have a web portal for a wallet. We worked with Everdon and we leveraged the work of One. I think we have also representatives here today. And then this provided a very simple API so that we were able to really hook this into the live website and display the verifiable credentials, which were published for public discovery. And it didn't take much. Basically, all the building blocks are there. So this is not something that is far from being real. And with that, we come to the use cases, and I give it back to Carla.
Okay, thank you, Christoph. So use cases, first we'll just supply a list. Although I said before that we were very, very interested in wanting to increase the adoption of the LAI in more private sector business related transactions, in order to be able to get everybody on board and to see their particular roles, we actually chose the first use case of a regulatory filing reporting. And we did the first one directly by the filer, to the filer, into the regulator. So the filer or the reporting entity directly into a regulator. In that case, we signed up actors in effect for the roles that Christoph went through before with us. As a result of those POCs, one on Hyperledger Indy and the other one on Ethereum, we also received feedback, especially from the US regulators, that it's not unusual for a third party filer to be filing on behalf of a legal entity, or for an auditor also to be in the chain of events some of these regulatory filings. So those would be additional variations on that use case. We see tremendous potential in the use of the LAI and verifiable credentials in the client onboarding process. So rather than to shift papers around and doesn't take away the verification that needs to be, but it would certainly streamline it by a client being able to apply to a financial institution, for example, for a service, to present their documents that they need to, accompanied by a verifiable credential. That could be verified that they are actually on the list of people who can officially represent that company in the client onboarding, and then further along in the Know Your Customer process. We also see huge capability and promise in import-export, supply chain, customs border control. We have something going on there. Tied to the financial services industry as well, even if it's just for the payment for goods. But this also makes sense that a lot of the coverage for the current coverage for the LAI system is in the capital markets and financial services area, and for institutions, for things like factoring and documentary credits and other invoice financing, anything like that, any financing that would be tied to any of these functions. We have a current POC going on with a trusted supplier and provider membership and registration. In this, it's the first use case that we've done similar to what I've described for client onboarding, that the credential is actually used as part of the process to apply for something else. And in this particular case, it could be to go through the approval process to become in an entity's procurement system, to be an authorized vendor or an authorized provider. And so the credentials could be used as part of the registration that is presented for membership and or inclusion or approval on such a network. Another current POC that we have ongoing is payment system membership and registration. In this particular one, we have a couple of new things going on. We are actually looking at a system that is already up and running and already has transactions over it. So we have financial institutions and other payment providers that are doing payment remittance transactions. And so this is the first time we're getting into a transaction process flow that's existing. And then there are also regulators as part of this network as well. So each regulator is entitled to be able to see the activity of the kind of entity that it regulates. So it has certain entitlements based on its verifiable credentials in order to be able to see transactions for the purposes of counterterrorist financing, anti-money laundering, and sanction screening, for example. We talked a little bit about executing business contracts and even with, you know, business entity registration and licenses, and also by keeping close ties to data protection and regulation in order to be able to not disclose PII, as Christoph talked about, but also to design the systems in some way that someone can be forgotten. In effect, one of the important tenets of GDPR in the EU. Next slide. That's it.
That was it.
That's it. So we'd be happy. We thank you for allowing us to present today. We'd be happy to take any of your questions.
Yeah, excellent presentation. One thing I'll say is that it looks like you have proven, at least in the Hyperledger case, that, as Christoph said, that all the building blocks were there to make this fairly easy. You know, on that technical slide, it looked like you were doing half of what I call layer three. You had to build out and then the top layer, of course, for the applications. But it looks like, according to Christoph, the rest of what was there with Vaughn and everything else, Indy and Aries and so on, was, I'll call it, ready to roll, if I'm correct.
Yep. That is exactly the case. So we were really pleased to see how much was there already. And basically, we just had a partner connecting some of these blocks for us and making it available via a very, really a thin API layer so we could integrate this with our existing technology. And that was that.
Also, I would like to add here that we've just recently become a founding member, a contributor member of the Trust Over IP Foundation as well, and are very interested in offering the LEI in this context in order to be able to be a foundational element of being able to secure digital and authenticate digital identity across a series of use cases, almost like a drop-in in effect once the architecture and the governance frameworks are in place.
So, yeah, thanks. Well, thanks for both joining Trust Over IP and for the presentation. So you link down to the role, and that you made that clear, and you also made clear that roles would be public information, but obviously no PII. But do you foresee in this corporate you mentioned at the top, a lot of this came out of the banking fallout. How do you see a linkage to people in this? Has that topic come up so that you can hold people responsible, individual people, real people, natural persons, as we call it in ISO TC 307, right? Do you see that linkage coming about?
I'm hoping that I'm interpreting your question correctly, but We also do have the appreciation that an organization verifiable credential that was originally put in place, you know, because of the fact that the entity that wants to issue it and wants to be able to be responsible for it can configure that verifiable credential in any way that it wishes. So in the context of what we're talking about here, you can envision a credential that would have the person's name, their start date, their current role, maybe their salary, address, beneficiary information, all kinds of things like that. Almost like an HR function, like when you walk into a company, you know, for the first day, they must establish their credentials that they're going to give you. And in this case, establish them in a digital way. And, you know, there will be some information about that person that will be relevant to their role in the organization, signing contracts, doing regulatory filings, you know, officially representing that company on the company's behalf. But we've also realized that from a natural person perspective, so from an individual perspective, that these VCs that originally were issued in the organizational context, if I could call it that,
yeah,
also could be of value to the person. And so think of me getting my head of standards and managing director of Glyph VC and going to a financial institution and wanting to buy a car, get a loan for a car, for example, rather than having to ring up and find out that I worked for Glyph. I could give them authorization to take a look at my to issue a proof against my organizational verifiable credential. It would prove that, one, I do work for the company, and I might also give them the permission to find out that I earn at least a certain salary to be able, so that they could judge whether I would be able to pay back the loan, to qualify and pay back the loan. So we do see that crossover, if that's what you were referring to.
Yeah, kind of, you know, so I worked for, yep.
Looks like Dan was talking more about a way in which they can be found responsible in case of, any wrongdoing.
That linkage. So like I work for Accenture, so I might have a verifiable credential, you know, in my wallet that says, the legal entity identifier that of Accenture, and that my role at Accenture is whatever, principal director. And I could share that verifiable credential and prove that I have a valid Accenture credential and that I have a valid role. But how do they tie that to a natural person? In other words, like I could also have in my wallet my Department of State issued passport once they virtualize it. And maybe the requester could ask for that information separately, but they're two separate things. So I could prove that I'm Dan Bachenheimer based on the photo in my passport. And I guess because it came from me and it's signed by me, that I also shared my Accenture legal entity and my role signed by Glyph. But I just don't see how, apart from me sharing those two verifiable credentials, how they're linked. There's nothing that link in that links my, let's say, my biometric, my face, to the Glyph attestation, verifiable credential that I have an Accenture role, you know?
There isn't, because that's not the way actually we would design the chain of trust.
Okay.
So the legal entity in this case is responsible for issuing the verifiable credentials to its own employee. So the verification that you work for Accenture is given by your organization, not by Glyph.
Right, okay.
Okay, and you know, I do get your point that, and also something else to clarify is it wouldn't be in your wallet, the organization credential. It would be in Accenture's wallet.
Ah, okay, yeah, that was my misunderstanding. Good, okay, then it makes sense. Yep, thanks.
But you might need to, and that's a good point though, Dan. I mean, we have, you know, a ton of other use cases where, for example, you would need to both prove that you worked for Accenture and that you are you, and the combination of two different credentials, the one that was issued to you by Accenture and then the fact that proves that you're Dan Bachenheimer could be your passport, and you might have to present two in order to be able to satisfy some verification.
Looks like we have Jonathan Holt has had his hand up for a while. So Jonathan, you want to ask a question or something?
Yeah, I was just curious about the logistics of exchanging the credentials and in your use case, did you go down the route of the CHAPI, the credential handler API, or did COM? Just the logistics of exchanging in your organizational structure.
Yeah. So in this proof of concept, we basically worked on the assumption that there was a portal. So our use case was the regulatory reporting. So it was about filings that had to be made. And what we had done is there was a portal from a regulator where a filing was to be submitted. And that was basically the communication point where there were these two roles. We had the role of the signer and the submitter, because we learned this is not always the same role, and certainly not always the same person who basically used their credentials to sign the document and then via a portal provided it to a regulator, and they were then able to validate the signatures basically based on the verifiable credentials.
Okay, so more just sort of external backend API. Okay, how about also you mentioned revocation. And so what was the model you used for revocation?
So I guess you technically all understand this much better than I do, but the revocation mechanism that was in place there was based on being anchored actually on the blockchain system, so on the sovereign ledger. So as far as I understood it, it works like when you work with digital certificates and you know revocation lists, and it never really worked because nobody is looking at these lists and it's hard to distribute them. It seems that the revocation of credentials really happens via data on the ledger, and that means that once connected to the sovereign network, you are able, basically as part of the verification request, to automatically do this check for revocation. So a request for verification would not return valid if the credential had been revoked.
Okay, thanks.
I guess we had pictured, John, that some of the responsibilities and processes that organizations would need to deliver in the analog world also would need to carry over into the digital world. So if I'm establishing an organization wallet in effect, I want to be able to manage when people change roles, as their responsibilities change, as we add new people, as people leave the company, and to actually manage that actively. We also discussed some feedback with some of the legal entities who we had as part of the POCs as to what features they might put in order to be able to support that. So maybe to put in an annual reissuance program so that the VC, it didn't have to, but they could decide that these would only be valid for a year and that they would need to be renewed at a particular point in time. And another legal entity might decide to leave them open-ended and then just manage the active ones by revocation as people changed roles and or left the company.
Looks like Luca's got his hand up.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for this presentation. I was very interested since my company is a sovereign steward. It's also a certification, a qualified certification authority, and an LEI issuer. So we are at the meeting of this discussions. My question is, you claim that in fact you are technology neutral. That's very good starting point. What's the real bottom, at the very bottom, what's the real value that you got from using verifiable credential instead of saying X509 certificates or attribute certificates which would, in the end, I see that you tried both ways. Did you see a real advantage, say business advantage, which is perceivable in using this technology? What's the bottom line? Thanks.
We did, but we also want to state and acknowledge that it all depends on what you're trying to do. And we actually do see a purpose going forward for the older, more mature digital certificates and this more newer technology in the verifiable credentials. Christoph alluded to some of it before. It's not as if there are flaws necessarily about the digital certificates themselves, but one thing in both, we think that we have a good improvement in effect with the amount of reference data that needs to have to be either inside a verifiable credential or inside a digital certificate about the organization itself. So our VCs and our digital certificates are very, very skinny. LEI name and role, in effect. The LEI points back to reference data that otherwise in the past had needed to be put in a digital certificate. And people are not really good at revoking them and getting them reissued if something changes inside the certificate. By using the LEI, we automatically are pointing back to current reference data that we've been given. The other thing was the fact that we could have automatic and automated verification with the verifiable credentials. If that's not an important feature, in effect, maybe some use cases would be better served by the more traditional digital certificates. But then, you know, again, we don't see a good discipline in effect of, you know, people easily being able to check revocation lists or even initiating, as I said, that revocation if a piece of data within the certificate is changed. We also saw a difference in what you were trying to do. So if the purpose was to secure our annual report, for example, a document and in an accompanying inline XBRL, so that it can't be tampered with if it sits on the GLIFE website or if it goes somewhere else, digital certificate is fine. If you also wanted, in addition to that, to secure the ecosystem and the relationships and the interactions among players, we thought that the verifiable credential route was a better choice.
Sorry, are you speaking?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Unmuting helps, obviously. No, I was just saying, agreed with everything, obviously, and it's generally the flexibility that we thought would be an advantage if verifiable credentials can be applied. The fact that a legal entity can issue verifiable credentials to their employees themselves and not having to go to a certificate authority for that, by that chain of trust model, or something that we found advantages.
Thank you.
Is Anshu got his hand up?
We couldn't hear you, Vipin.
I think you tried to say somebody had their hand up. Perhaps the person can just ask the question.
I think Anshu was next.
Yeah. With his hand. Thank you. Thank you for a futuristic presentation with endless possibilities, if I were to fantasize about them. A few starting questions. So today, legal entities have some sort of identifiers. There is in the European Union an EORI number. In UK, there is a company's house number. Is there an idea to map the legal identifier to these numbers Or would these 35 agencies, would the governments be agencies that would issue these verifiable credentials and then form this mapping so that companies then get a package? This is your company's house number or EORI number, and this is your legal entity identifier. Is that the direction in which this concept is intended to go?
That is a possibility, but first I must go back to where we are today. So of the 36 LEI issuers that we have, some are national business registries that exist today in effect. So in addition to issuing the business register number on a national level, they also participate in the global LEI system. Also, it was very important, having been around at the time that the standard was formed and working with the regulators in order to be able to put the standard together. It was important to the regulators to have this link between the national registry number to the extent that it exists for legal entities. One thing that also we should say that the entity categories that we can assign LEIs to are not just garden variety, general legal entities like companies, incorporated, etc. We also do funds, foundations, branches, trusts, funds, pension funds, etc., etc. So not all exist in a business registry. But for the ones that do, there is part of the LEI reference data, the name of the registry where that entity was formed, and if it's allowed to be published without limitations, the national number that was assigned at that particular point in time. So there's automatically a link, if it can be populated, with the national registry, and then going from the global system down to the information, even down to financial reports and things like that, that might need to be published on a more local level.
Is there a case to anonymize this in the interest of fraud? So if I know the LEI of a company, I may try and act as a representative of a company in areas that there is that there could be a weakness, and pretend to be a representative of a company. So the heart of the question is like the way credit cards are going, where they are trying to anonymize, or let's say, I forget the name, they put another number that resolves to the original number. Is that a thought? Is there a use case to that it goes in that direction?
I would think that it breaks down if the verification process would be used, because if we're talking about a legal entity assigning verifiable credentials to its employees and official representatives, and then placing these in the wallet, as soon as the fabricated one goes to be used and a proof request is issued in order to be able to see that it's correct and accurate, it would come back no, because it doesn't exist in the organization wallet.
Thank you. I have a few other questions, but I'll leave it for later if there is time or another time. So
you can also always interact on email, and hopefully we can forward it to Carla and Christoph. We need to continue the conversation, obviously, since we are always limited by time, by 1 hour.
Thank you.
But we try to foster this using other asynchronous media, like the wiki, like the emails. Anyway, Jim also has his hand up, so I want to encourage him to ask a question, and then I think we are almost at time anyway.
I'll try to be quick. I want to go, give me a scenario, help me with a scenario. Most organizations will have their LEI. I'll be part of an organization, so I'll get a verifiable credential saying I'm part of an organization. Most organizations are probably not going to publish the fact that I'm working for them into a global directory with the issuer. So in a sense, it won't be discoverable publicly that I work for such and such an organization. So given that, when I worked for a company like IBM, I had a physical ID, and if I would go someplace that I just wanted to go, I could prove with the physical ID that I worked for IBM. Given that you said the role assignments, if you will, the credentials for those roles that are issued are in the organization's wallet, and I'm needing to prove that I'm working for IBM, let's say, do I get a copy of that verifiable credential in my own wallet to present?
We had not anticipated that there would be a copy in that. We had in our own minds up until this particular point thought that in the example that I gave before to the bank, about the bank loan, for example, right now, verifying that you work for IBM is probably a phone call to some HR department central switchboard number that routes you, and they would have to speak to a person to say, Jim, you work for IBM, type of thing. What we anticipated there was that you would authorize the bank to go to IBM and ask them to verify on behalf of your verifiable credential that you in fact are an employee.
That might make sense for a business loan or personal loan, whatever. But for example, in the IBM case, I would go to the Modern Museum of Art in New York for free, just showing my credential. Having to go all the way back to the organization seems like a lot of extra work.
Coming back to this, the root of this question, it is not meant to be a generic identity card from the organization. It is for legal representation in contracts. That's what I thought the LEI linked role was for, not for any.
You can get all of that.
Is it meant only for?
You're breaking it up again, unfortunately.
Oh, sorry.
But I think what would be important to add is that when we started with the topic, and it's all backed on this idea of self-sovereign identity, and everything was, designed around individual people, like wallets on phones and stuff. And this is when we came up with the organization wallet, because we just were aware that for this to work in an organizational context, certain management capabilities need to be in place, and that the organization must be able to manage the credentials for their employees. Obviously, if somebody leaves, then somebody else has to have the power over that. Yeah, it's delegation. And following up on Jim's question, the idea would be that the individual, like the person representing the business, would have the power to control their own credential, but also some kind of administrator. So there would not be a copy. I think that would make sense. But it's more that the person is not the only one being able to control it. And there it's when you need the permissioning levels and all the, I mean, today's world is not gone. You need all the functionalities that you have in today's management systems also for this. This is where the idea of the organization wallet comes from. And just to quickly address also the question from Roland in the chat about the sensitivity levels, I think this is exactly what's baked into the SSI technology as a very core feature, that no matter if you have one or 20 pieces of information in a credential, you as the holder, whatever that means in the end of the day, decide which parts you disclose and which you don't.
Thanks, everyone.
We have lost Jim.
I think we have to close the meeting now. I don't know whether I'm being heard, but thanks to Carla and Christoph for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for inviting us. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.